Welcome to the Hunt Back Country podcast. This is episode number 454, and our guest is Dr. Andy Galpin. Andy is a human performance scientist with a PhD in human bioenergetics. He's the co-director of the Center for Sport Performance. He's a tenured full-time professor at California State University of Fullerton, and he has worked with elite athletes across the UFC, Major League Baseball, NBA, PGA, NFL, boxing, Olympics, the military special forces, and he's also a hunter. And I didn't know that about Andy. I'd heard Andy's name. I had seen some of his content on YouTube. I had heard him on podcasts. And he has a ton of great information out there about human performance, training, nutrition, and more. But I just heard this small little brief clip of him mentioning hunting, and that really caught my interest. And so I reached out to Andy, and he was more than happy to come on the show to talk about some of his professional expertise and how that can pair with us as backcountry hunters. So this is a fantastic episode. I'm really excited to share it with you guys. We did ask you for listener questions before we recorded this one. And so some of the questions and topics that you guys submitted and that we get into in this conversation have to do with training, nutrition, and supplementation strategies for hunting at higher elevations. We talk about the metrics from wearable devices, such as smartwatches, and if they are reliable and beneficial. We discuss why exercise science is continually changing, how to prioritize strength versus endurance, and a whole lot more. As always, guys, if you have any follow-up questions to this or you just have any feedback to share with us, you can always send an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. If you're enjoying the show, it truly does help us tremendously if you can leave a rating or review in whatever podcast app that you use, or just share the show directly with a friend. Also in the show description, as you will hear us mention during our conversation with Andy, there are a ton of resources and links to learn more about Andy's work and how that can benefit you, and so be sure to check that out as well. But right now, let's go ahead and dive into this conversation with Dr. Andy Galpin. Well, Andy, welcome to the show. Really excited to chat with you today. If you can, just start with an introduction and background, 30,000 foot view of who you are, what you do, or listeners who may not be aware.
Yeah, sure. My real job is I'm a scientist and a professor. So I study human performance. I work at the Center for Sport Performance at Cal State Fullerton, and we study and disseminate research that enhances human performance. So this is anything from nutrition and supplementation to training, to breath work, to muscle physiology, biochemistry, cellular and molecular aspects, to human performance and force production and how you activate your muscles, and really anything in between. So our job is to study human performance and to disseminate that. We, of course, publish research in that area and present at conferences and all that stuff. In addition, I work directly with a lot of high-performance athletes. So we've worked with NFL players, NBA players, PGA Tour golfers, Olympians, world champions, UFC fighters, the most famous drummers in the world, just really anybody who has to perform physically at their highest. And so we currently work with athletes across probably 15 or so sports, including kind of the number one player in the world and four of the biggest ones here in America, and abroad. So we take a little bit of research and then we apply it to humans, and we learn, you know, scientifically what works in the real world, and then we enhance performance through design. So it's a back and forth relationship there. And that's for the most part what I do is try to learn more about human performance and then try to help people actually perform at their best.
Fascinating. We will dive into a lot of that based off of curious questions that I have, some listener questions that were sent in. But to tie this to our podcast and our audience, I heard you mention in passing, as I was listening to a different podcast, something about hunting, and that made me really intrigued to reach out to you, which is kind of how we got here today. If you don't mind sharing, what is your like background, history, connection with hunting?
Hunting is, and hunting related activities probably occupies more of my day than just about anything else outside of my job. When people ask me, kind of like, well, what do you do for fun? I never can answer that question because it's human performance, right? So if I'm watching a golf tournament, I'm also working. If I'm getting ready for my next hunt, like I'm also working. So it's really the same thing. And hunting is a really huge component of that. So I grew up in rural Southwest Washington, in a little small community. And I know it's kind of interesting where hunting has gotten a little more popular in the media these days, but that's just what I grew up with. I come in a hunting community. Everybody I knew hunted. That's part of every kid in high school. This is what we did. I didn't get to hunt a lot because I went on to play college football and, of course, in a doctoral program. So I'm in different states. I'm moving all around the country. As a college football player, it's very difficult to hunt because your weekends in the fall are pretty occupied. And so my college years and stuff, I didn't really get to do as much hunting. And then, so it wasn't until I got out of that stuff and got my real job where I got to get back into it. But it's pretty much how I schedule the rest of my life, to be totally honest, is around, what tags we're going after, what we draw, and then kind of, where I'm at. And even like, to be totally honest, even our data collection in our labs, I'm like, oh, I can't do it that week. Like that's, I'm gonna be out here. Like I will schedule our studies around our hunts and draws and all that stuff. So yeah, it's a really, really big part of my life. My freezer is full of game meat for the most part. That's what we eat. My kids, even though I live in Southern California right now and have for a while, my kids don't know any different. So that's just like it's just totally normal for them to eat antelope and elk and things like that. And I make a talk all day about hunting. The
That's
more we talk
awesome.
about it, the better. But yeah, that's I'm a West Coast guy, I guess, for context. So it is mountain hunting, it is things like that. It is mule deer and antelope, elk, for the most part. Where I grew up, it's all blacktail, of course, basically. So we're out doing that. So I've never really done any whitetail or any stuff on the East Coast, but that's pretty much deer hunting and deer related stuff is what I do.
I was
So
gonna
that's
ask, what
super
would be
cool.
your favorite, like if you were gonna go hunt tomorrow and get to pick any hunt, what would you do?
Oh, mule deer, no question.
Mule deer? Yeah.
No doubt about it. Like, I don't know, there's this magic. My dad actually was super lucky. He got a record book antelope a couple of years ago. And we've had elk and all that. And like there's something majestic about these giant dinosaur-like horses that are elk. I get it. I get it. But man, there's like that public land mule deer is just like it's so revered in my brain where I'm like, I can't ever get every time we go to pick, I'm like, God, I just can't not pick mule deer this year. Like, I just can't. I just can't get away from it ever.
Yeah. Are you archery or rifle?
All
Or
rifle.
both? All rifle. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I got love for the archers, all that, but where I live and what we do, I don't have any time. It would be a giant part of my day every day to practice archery enough.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sufficient in that where just keeping touched up enough on my rifle is easy enough.
Yeah. I don't know how to, I have this idea in my head, Andy, but I don't know how to phrase it into a succinct question, so bear with me. But as I was thinking about, and we've talked plenty about training and physical fitness and nutrition and preparing for hunts and supplementation and preparing for altitude, like all the things, and we'll talk more about some of that. When I think of human performance and training, fitness, nutrition, etc., it's like in preparation for this hunting adventure is how I generally think about it and how I think most people do in these conversations. I somehow want to flip that and hear from you on not the preparation for a hunt, but almost like the physical, perhaps mental, perhaps emotional, spiritual benefits of a hunt, right? So like if you were to go out and take that week and go offline and put yourself in the mountains and just live in that wild environment 24/7 for a week and just have the things you have on your back and just like live this hunt for a week. Now, how do you prepare for that? But what is that doing for you? Does that make sense? Like from a
Yeah, no,
physical
it totally
perspective?
does. Yeah, I absolutely get it. It's not preparing to maximize the hunt and the success there, but it is what's the benefit of going on in the first place? I mean, that's really the question. There's a lot of ways I can answer this. I actually wrote a book a number of years ago called Unplugged, and this was a large part of it. And so what does the science say about the benefits, short and long term, of things like exposure to nature? And there's a lot actually there. I can summarize the book. None of you need to buy it. On my YouTube, I made like a 5-minute video, and I basically like, here's the gist of the book. So you can save all your money, just go watch that video there. But there's a lot of research on, let's just take aging of your brain as one example. And I can do this for many different areas of your body, but that is one clear example. There's a lot of things that go into successful brain aging. When you look at things like late onset Alzheimer's and dementia, most people don't realize those are almost entirely preventable. Now, early onset Alzheimer's is, nothing you can do about that. But dementia, and the more and more research we get on that, we realize that it is not entirely, but very close to entirely preventable. And the components that go into that are things like physical exercise, social connection, sense of purpose, proprioception, learning new skills. This could be language, this could be music, things like that. And so you start looking on this list of ideas, and you start thinking about going out on a hunt, and you're like, well, okay, social connection, but like the opposite. Okay, so we don't get that one, so that's fine. We're getting physical exercise for sure. Sense of purpose, 100%. I think if you were to talk to hunters with their guard down a little bit, especially ones who do stuff like this, I mean, I can't even get the words out, as you guys couldn't, to articulate just how much more real the world feels when you're hunting. At least that's what it is for me. I live in the city now, where like, I can't stand it every single day, right? But like when I finally got out to hunt, I'm like, finally, like I'm finally doing something that is like real in that matter. So I get personally a tremendous sense of purpose when I'm out there. We also, and the last one I'm getting to really is one of the real struggles people have is with this idea or with this physiological principle called proprioception. That's a fancy word for saying your senses. And so people don't realize oftentimes your brain physically has to be engaged in as many of your senses in a novel way possible. If not, the neurons die, if you can think about it that way. And so you have nerves that are a whole bunch of nerves that are associated with keeping your smell sharp. Well, if you're smelling the same things every day or don't have a lot of variety, those tend to dull out. Well, that's actually your brain. And so you are literally losing your brain physically, like the physical size, the physical space starts to deteriorate. The same thing for your sense of sight and hearing and also balance. So if you were to go do the exact same workout, say on a treadmill, that's great, that's still exercise, but you're not getting the proprioception component to it because you're not having to worry about where's your next step. Are you going up? Are you going down? Is the terrain different? Your vision is the same thing. So when you're in an environment like I'm in, and I'm looking at my screen and everything is the same distance away, when you're out in the real world, you're looking at things that are inches away from your foot for your next step. You're looking at things that are a couple of feet away, things that are miles in the distance. And so you're constantly smelling different things. You're hearing different sounds. You're listening for sounds that are dull versus sharp versus, do I really need to be aware of a little bit of danger right now? Is there a bear coming through the woods or is there the thing I'm after? Or like, so your senses are going, and all of them are going bonkers every second of every day, even when you're sleeping. You're obviously not sleeping generally, super well, but your senses are going. And so that part is very, very important for your brain. And that is one of the most difficult things to re-engineer in normal people's lives, right? Because it's like, oh, what am I going to go out on a hike in nature? Well, yeah. Okay, great. So like in my case, you want me to drive like an hour and a half, hoping there's no traffic to finally get to where I can park to go out and walk into, like, all right, that's never going to happen. It's going to take my entire day to go on a hike. This is no thing. So getting out and hunting, you're doing many, many aspects of that. And the last component I'll say, and I'll pause after this and you can kind of come back with any questions, but you're also now getting exposed to temperature and thermal stressors. In our house, I'm as guilty as anybody. We are very rarely hot. We're very rarely cold. We're not really thirsty ever. And we're generally not very hungry. Now, some people can go on a diet and they can do the hunger thing, but temperature-wise, you're not getting exposed to any of that. There are physiological processes in your body that are intentionally there and they have downstream positive effects to handle thermal regulation. And so when you don't ever activate them, the same thing, they die. They go away if you want, it's called downregulation physiologically. But that's what happens. And so when we're going out on things like a hike, like we're getting not only the mental release or whatever, if you need the break and the stress, you're getting something in your year to plan for, right? You've probably put in your tags, months and months in advance. You've spent a bunch of money. You've taken time, like all these things go into it. So you have that benefit of like purpose because you're preparing for something specifically, but then you get all the physical benefits as well of just being out in nature. So I mean, I could go on and on, but there is a ton that goes into just being out. If you're using that to like hunt an animal, that's great. That's what we do. If not, if you're just using it on like a camping trip, you would still get most of those same benefits. But the significant difference is when you have an animal on the line, now you actually have things that matter. And so camping is cool, but it's not the same as hunting.
It's fun to hear, like Mark, I'm sure you can relate to, is just when you're back, like we all just dream and like really just want to get back into the backcountry. Like you're miserable out there, but you know
Totally.
there's something going on, because it's like the second you get home, like I can't, like I'm already planning the next trip. It's like a drug, and I know there's all these benefits, but I can't, I can't pinpoint them, right? I don't do what you do. It's fun to hear kind of that. Some of the things going on behind the scenes that we're just not aware of, but obviously your body and your mind is telling you like, this is good for you. Come back, do more.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole other host of things that are happening as well, just from a perspective of novelty, right? There's just nothing else in your life you're doing for the most part that is singularly focused like that. So when you're out hunting, especially if you're hunting big game in the West, when you see something and it is 1,200 yards away, that might be several hours of work. And a good chance is you're going to work all day, many days in a row, and you're not going to come home with anything. Like, can you just imagine if like you spent that much time on one work project, not one big, like this one little tiny thing, and then it's like, hey, there's a 60% chance this turns into nothing. Now, there's no other side emails, there's no other saying hi to your family, like this is nothing else going on, and you have one shot at one thing. And you're probably almost surely going to fail. And so the ability to have tremendous internal focus on a single task. And this is one of the major issues that we have in our current landscape, which is fine, humans will adapt, but as you have constant arousal, what that means is you have an email coming in, you have a text, you have a Twitter message, you have a DM, you have a family, you have a phone call, right? Somebody stopped by, like we're constantly, we have music going on, and we're listening to a podcast, and there's information in, information in, information in. This creates a decent amount of basal arousal. And this has all kinds of functional problems. When you're out hunting, all of that goes away. Like you don't even have service typically. If you do, like you're not pulling out your phone and checking these things. And if you are, it's like even a couple of times a day for the most part, right? For the most part, all that goes away and that goes to nothingness. And you wonder why you feel great. It's because it's not necessarily that arousal is bad. It's not necessarily that you don't want those things to be 50-50. But right now, in most people's current landscape, it is 99% arousal, 0%, 1% downregulation. When you go out there, you flipped it and you're like, oh my God, you have this sense of euphoria. And everything else just goes away because you have one thing to pay attention to. And that is more typical of how a human evolved, is to be in spurts like that, concentrated, focused effort, and then complete openness, single task. Not tons and tons and tons of tiny little tasks all the time. So that benefit alone as well, of just getting out and being able to pay attention to basically one thing, right? Like you're watching, where's the animal I'm looking for? Where's any potential danger? How am I going to get to that animal? Where's my next meal? Am I safe in this? Like you're paying attention to a few things, but not much else. And those things are important because they, in this world, it's literally life and death, and that could be either side of the rifle could be at risk of life and death. Very few people are at risk of dying, in depending on the email they send. So it's a little bit of a different task.
There's so much there. Thank you. That was such a cool overview. And I want to pull in so many threads, but in the interest of time, probably shouldn't pull in too many. I am curious. So like we take this week-long hunt, and that for many of the listeners is probably like, it's the event of the year. For some fortunate folks, they get to do that multiple times a year.
Bastards, all of you.
But if you take some of those benefits, especially on like the physical side, especially like you said, the proprioception stuff, the exposure to non-sterile elements and climates, and you put that in smaller areas of exposure. So like for me, and I literally feel this right now, I haven't been outside and done something physical, even small, in 2 days. And when that happens to me, I literally don't like, I'm almost like anxious about it. And I think part of that is maybe just natural because I have been consistently, active and get outside 5+ days a week for at least an hour at a time per day for like, the last 15 years. Is that like, so when I don't get that for a couple of days, is that anxiety in me partially because, hey, that's just my habit, that's my routine, that's what I'm used to, that's just Mark? Or is that something like my body telling me, I don't know if that's, I don't even, I'm not a scientist, so I'm speaking way out of context here. Is that like something in me, physiology in me, hormonal something? Or is that just Mark going, yeah, I'm used to getting outside, and when I don't get to do that for a couple of days, I get anxious. Does
Well,
that
the
question even
answer
make
is,
sense?
yeah, totally is. The answer is it's absolutely both. And what I mean by that is the greatest gift human physiology has is its ability to recognize pattern. And this is what separates us from any other animal, in my opinion, is we are better at pattern recognition and then adaptability. What I mean by that is if you were to do a pattern where you're outside and you're cleaning stalls for 30 minutes every day, this is what you do. You go back in and you work all day, you're at a computer, who cares? But you clean stalls in the morning and evening, like this is what you do. If you don't do that, that pattern is going to jump out at you. Now, it doesn't matter if you're cleaning stalls or eating Doritos. It is simply pattern recognition. Whenever you have something that you're doing that frequently, that consistently, and your body's expecting that, it's going to send you adverse signals to say, hey, we're waiting for this thing to happen. It's not happening. Something's off here. So part of it is simply physiological. It is also pattern recognition. Now, what you're really trying to ask is that your body's way of saying to go do something that is healthy for it? Part of it is that too. But honestly, the biggest answer is it is pattern recognition. If you were to choose a different pattern and it is a negative thing, it would crane for that. And this is why so many people are so unhealthy. Is if you the easiest example is after lunch and after dinner every day, just have an ice cream cone or a Snickers bar. You will not make it 3 or 4 days before, as soon as you start eating lunch, you immediately start thinking about your ice cream. Like you'll go right into it, right? Because it goes, hey, pattern recognition. And it's not because sugar is more addictive than cocaine or any of that dumb shit that people say. It is simply pattern recognition. If you finish lunch and have a coffee, it'll be the same thing. If you finish lunch and do breath work, it would be the same thing. If you finish lunch and then go for a run, it would be the same thing. And so it body tends to recognize pattern, and then it punishes you for deviating from pattern. And that's really what you're experiencing for the most part. You're just not fortunate in the sense that you've set that pattern around something that is incredibly beneficial to your body. And so it's telling you to get out and move and to get out and be outside. And that's a great thing.
Thus, the power of good small daily habits.
Huge. Yeah, huge.
I think I've heard different stats on like how long it takes to firmly establish a habit.
Well, any stat you've heard is a lie. I can tell you that. Because it entirely depends on the habit. But you will see ha things happen generally very quickly. So anything in the like 3 to 14 day range can absolutely be sufficient. Some things take much longer. The reason I'm saying that is parts of your body respond to stimuli within milliseconds. Right now, some of them don't respond for days. And so it is a little bit of like, well, there's not one answer there, but the quick version is if you do something new or novel, positive or negative, for somewhere in that 3 to 14 day range, it'll be pretty close to set in as a pattern. Now, the way that we say this is the hard part about physiology is not velocity, but acceleration. And what I mean by that is, look, if you wake up 7 days a week at 3 a.m. Well, it will not take you very long before waking up at 3 a.m. becomes very, very normal. And now waking up at 3 or 3:30 is no longer hard. So the velocity of, hey, I wake up at that time every single day, it's not very hard anymore. What's really, really hard is if you went from waking up at 9 o'clock every day and then tomorrow you woke up at 3 a.m. That's acceleration. That is a rapid change in pace. That's going to hurt. Even if you equate it for total number of hours slept, it is going to hurt a lot more because it is a different, it is an acceleration. So changing habits is always about just getting through that acceleration piece. Whether you're adding in workouts, whether you're changing your nutrition, whether you're doing a pattern like brush your teeth in the morning, right? The first day you go to brush your teeth in the morning, you're like, oh my God, this is such a pain. This is so much time. But none of you think about how much time it takes to brush your teeth. Like it's not a thing you're worried about. It takes 5 minutes, right? But if I said I need you to do 5 minutes of breath work every day, the resistance to that is massive because it's a change, right? Once you do breath work and you're like, oh, I've done breath work every day for 3 minutes, it's like, what do you mean? If I just change the word breath workout for brushing your teeth, all of a sudden one of them is like completely accepted. Of course you would do that. And the other one is like, wow, I don't have time for that shit. And the reality of it is the only reason you have time for that shit of brushing your teeth is because your parents made you do it when you're 4 years old and you've been doing it for 40 years. So that velocity is, you don't know anything different. Change of pace is what would make things hard. And so it's really always about the acceleration.
Very cool. I tried to group a ton of thoughts I had and then also combine that. We reached out to listeners and let them know we were going to be speaking with you on the podcast and just kind of get some questions and topics that they wanted to hear. And we'll try and move through as much of these as possible. And then I'm trying to group some different specific questions into common themes. But let me start here. Do metrics matter? And then let me narrow down on that with some specific questions that came up. What are some of your thoughts on wearables and the usefulness of the data they provide? Things like HRV, which is heart rate variability, sleep ratings or sleep scores, recovery and readiness status, etc. And then to maybe expand on that, if those things matter, which specific metrics or measurements from a wearable may be most valuable.
Sure. I'll try to give you direct answers. My honest answer here, though, is what if I asked you, hey, what's a better meat, antelope or elk? What if I asked you, what's a better gun to hunt with, a shotgun or a rifle? You can't answer that question. You're like, well, are you hunting duck? Are you hunting, like, what are you
Right, yeah.
hunting? Like, it's an impossible. So those questions are impossible for me to answer because there is no, like, this is the best thing to pay attention to. There is no best wearable. There is no best way to use it. There is no best metric. They're all different. They have massive pros and cons. And that is the most important thing. So the question I'll always ask you is what are you hunting? And in this case, I mean it figuratively. What are you looking for? What problem are you trying to solve? Are you trying to solve a fatigue and you're sleepy all day? Or are you trying to solve you want to like your brain fog? Like what problem are we trying to solve? And then we'll use the technology. Or we won't use it based upon that. The easiest examples are like sleep trackers. There's actually a thing called orthosomnia where sleep trackers can cause people to have sleep disorders because they become obsessed and compulsive over the sleep tracking score that it actually starts ruining their sleep because they're so anxious and worried about what their score will be the next day that they don't sleep as well. And in fact, it can get so bad it can cause clinical sleep disorders. And so in that case, I would say, oh my gosh, there is literally scientific evidence that sleep trackers cause sleep disorders. There's also a mountain of evidence that suggests when people track their sleep and pay attention to it more, they're more accountable, they're more aware of their habits, and people tend to make better choices when they know they're being watched. And so I could show you scientific evidence that suggests any wearable made any metric better or made it worse. And so really, I would say, pay attention to the person. What's the goal? Do I need that? Is that the best use of my $400? Sometimes the answer is yes, sometimes it's not. So generally, technology is good for what I just said. Accountability, awareness. We will do this all the time with our people in our coaching program. So we have a company called Rapid Health and Performance, and we coach non-athletes in there. And they'll come in and they think they're sleeping some amount, or they think they're more active than they are, or they think their diet, everybody comes in and says, well, my diet's okay. It's not terrible, but it's it's pretty good. And like no matter who they are, they always say the same thing, right? So like that ranges from excellent diets to terrible ones, but they all have the same thing. And so it's just like, all right, do we need to weigh and measure your food? Do we need to have you tracking your calories? Do we need to use a technology for that? Maybe, maybe not. Some people that makes it worse. Do we need to have a step tracker? Maybe, maybe not. And so like my honest answer is all of those things. Now, all that context said, a couple things. We don't really use any wearable or tracker because we have ours. I have a sleep company called Absolute Rest, and we have our technology is just miles ahead of anybody else's. So unfortunately, my answer to tracking HRV and sleep and respiratory rate and all that is from our technology at Absolute Rest. So we will use those things. HRV globally is a pretty good indicator of your what's called allostatic load. So like your total stress load on your entire body. So your physical stress, your emotional stress, psychological stress, nutritional stress, stress from smoking or drinking or things like that. And that'll give you a pretty good indicator of where you're at. You can look at that if you want a global idea. My honest answer though is you probably know, right? We know by the time we're in about third grade what roughly nutrition should look like. You know what stress management should look like. You know what exercise does. You know what you're not supposed to be doing for the most part. So you can go spend some money, but until you go fix those things that are free anyways, I mean, I guess if you want to see your numbers, you can. But that's probably not the best place to start. Did that help at all answer that question? I know I kind of
No,
gave
it
a bunch
does.
of but
Yeah, no, it does. I don't know how to ask this question other than like pretty bluntly, but what you just said there at the end of like you already know what nutrition looks like by the time, you know, your third grade, stress management, etc. Does it ever get difficult or tiresome to have all these like optimization questions from people who are ignoring the basics?
more than you will ever understand. More, man, I get it. Look, the honest reality is a lot of people don't have the ability to afford like a lot of the programs that we've done, right? So I understand it's sort of like, hey, can you give me the 80%? I get it. Like, if I'm trying to figure out like financing or something that I'm like, hey, can you just like give me the gist of it? Like, so I'll ask the same question. I'm gonna get it when I'm going into other areas and not my expertise. It's just really difficult for me as someone who wants all of you to have the best answer possible to get the best results and to not go, yeah, listen to that guy and like it didn't work for shit. So it's hard for me to come out and be like, I'll just pay attention to A, B, and C because I know that's not the honest answer. Because the reality it is, I've worked with so many people over so many years. I just know that that's not true. So it's really hard for me to give you a number, give you an answer, knowing in my head I've seen people, I've worked with people who that would have just made things worse. So it's super hard for me to just be like, ah, just do it, it's fine. And then knowing some of you out there are gonna, suffer or at least hit suboptimal results because of that. So yeah, it's challenging. I know it's annoying to listen to, but it's challenging for me on this side to be like, ah, gosh, I don't want to give you a wrong answer here.
For sure. There's a ton of more training specific questions. Let's kind of, I don't know, start here as a theme. But and again, I know a lot of this is going to be it depends and caveats, etc. And we can narrow down. But along the theme of like strength and endurance, an example would be someone wrote in and said, I constantly struggle with how much to focus on strength versus endurance, aside from addressing obvious weaknesses. How should I focus on increasing and maintaining my fitness related to strength versus endurance? So I think the biggest obvious thing in there is like, well, what is your goals? What is your pursuit? What is your activity? Do you need more strength? Do you need more endurance, et cetera? But I think to pull on that a little bit, someone who's fairly well-rounded and balanced, I mean, I can somewhat relate to this because there's been times where I've gone, okay, I'm generally fit. You know, generally balanced. Like, how do I keep training? What do I focus on? Should I just take a periodized approach and focus on one then the other? You know, I just, you know, how do you set priorities essentially aside from very, very specific goals?
In that particular case, what I'd say is you want to generally focus on one thing for 6 to 8 weeks. Doesn't mean you're only doing it, but that becomes your top priority. And what I would generally say is pick the thing that you were the worst at and go after that. And so if we're looking at your strength and your endurance and you want to know which one to focus on, I'd say, well, which one's better? And if you're like, oh, I'm way stronger than I'm fit, then I'm like, okay, great. Take your lifting down to, twice per week. Do enough there, 30-minute workouts, really high intensity in terms of weight. So heavy, power and fast, low repetitions. Don't do that many sets of it. Feel really good and strong, feel really powerful, and then move on. Those are after the warm-up, those are very short workouts. You're not, again, maybe 5 repetitions or so per set, maybe less, maybe 3 to 5, something like that. You're not doing high repetition numbers there. And again, you're trying to move fast when the load is light, as fast as possible, and then trying to also load as high as you can. And that might not get you stronger, but it might give you enough to keep your current strength. That's great. And then you spend more of your recovery reserves on training intensity, conditioning intensity rather. And so then you're going after a combination of longer duration, lower intensity stuff, and doing that more frequently, doing some high intensity short work, maximal exercises could be, 30 seconds as hard as you can, 30 seconds rest for a bunch of rounds of that, any combination works there. And then doing something more of a moderate intensity. So this could be like a combination of like circuit training plus some intervals. Maybe it's sprint work, maybe it's different stuff like that, where you're kind of moving hard for 30 to 40 minutes. You're not totally at 100%, but you're not crawling along either, and you're not getting incredibly sore. In that particular case, I do something like that. If your issue is the opposite, then you would just flip that priority, right? And so you would do a small amount of conditioning, just keep going, and then really maybe go to 3, maybe 4 times a week of strength training and building those things out. So that is the honest reality, is you figure out what is the biggest hole, and then you focus on that for that 6 to 8 week span. If you're kind of thinking like, I'm a little bit of 50 and 50, okay, great. Still pick one. Which one do you want to have the most acceleration or progress in? And go from there. And so that's typically what I'll have people do, or what I recommend people do in this particular scenario, is get that little bit of focus so that you have something to go after. If you can find a metric to pick, then I would strongly encourage that. So maybe you want to deadlift to 300 pounds. Great. Maybe you want to be able to run under a 7-minute mile. Awesome. Maybe you want to hit a certain mark for, yeah, there's a certain trail you go on that you want. Like, it doesn't matter. Pick something so that you have a purpose and a sense and something to go after. If not, like, just working for the sake of working becomes really, really difficult. You're just sort of out there digging holes in the sand. And if you know exactly, hey, we're trying to put a fence line in here, great. Then go put that fence line. It doesn't even matter if that's where the fence needed to be, but you have some direction and purpose. So that's what I'd strongly recommend. So pick numbers, pick goals, and then go after them.
Purely from a health and longevity perspective, not necessarily a performance perspective or a peak performance perspective, where is the best strategy as it relates to strength and endurance? And this is a observational statement, so I don't know that it's accurate, but I feel observationally that if you go back maybe decade to 2 decades ago, there was a lot more focus on things like, oh, run, cardio, heart health, et cetera. And I do feel like that's swung even from a health and longevity perspective within maybe the last decade to be more of a strength focus, even for people who are aging, for example. Is there a right and wrong to that? Or is it just this simple matter of, hey, you need both, and culture is going to swing and have fads and do whatever?
Yeah, well, I mean, the honest reality of it is, it was a little bit like this. In the early 1900s, so probably up to 1940 or so, we really didn't think exercise was needed, and that's generally because it wasn't. Industrial revolution, really, as we know it now, hadn't happened yet. We're talking about getting ready for war. There's a Harvard fatigue lab in the 1920s and 30s that is crushing, and really that was focused on what's the minimum amount of calories one needs to get so that they don't die. And this is for putting people in coal mines. This is for putting people in factories, sending people out to war. What's the temperature that we can survive? What's the calories that we can survive? And trying to figure out fatigue. In this context, again, fatigue was what's a minimal kind of viable amount of vitamins we can give people, and before people end up having really, really big problems or dying. And that's kind of great. Exercise wasn't thought of as a thing for the most part because it didn't matter, right? In fact, if you've got the chance to not exercise, this is probably a really good thing, right? Because you're working very hard all day physically, one way or the other. Now, after World War II, things start to change a little bit. Harvard Fatigue Lab ends up closing, and there's a little bit of movement towards like some exercise stuff. At that point, though, scientifically, strength training was thought to be extremely deleterious to your health. There was the whole flexibility thing, right? So you lose flexibility. There is, it's going to hurt your joints. And like all these myths that are somewhat still around really began in that time. It wasn't until the mid-1950s when a couple of things happened. Number one, we summited Mount Everest for the first time. We eclipsed the 4-minute mile for the first time. In that 1954, 55, 56 range, all this happened. You saw a launch of what's called the National Strength and Conditioning Association, the American College of Sports Medicine. And so scientifically, people were like, oh my gosh, we can make a science out of exercise. Also, one of the biggest, a guy named Peter Karpovitz, one of the biggest proponents of strength training being bad for your health, completely flipped his tune. Started producing research showing that not only was it not bad for you, that it was actually potentially okay. It pretty much stayed still there. The initial scientists in this area were all endurance athletes, cyclists, swimmers, and runners. And so all of the research on this entire field of exercise physiology and nutrition and training for the 1950s all the way up to the 1990s for the most part was done on that steady state endurance type of stuff. So all the research on, hey, exercise is good for your health, et cetera, it's all exactly what you just said, Mark. It's all like endurance, 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 and cardiovascular health, right? We could no longer make the argument that strength training would make you lose flexibility or it was bad for your heart or anything, but we had no rationale to think it was actually good for you. And then everything changed when Arnold came around. He hit us with pumping iron, and then Conan came out, and everyone's like, holy shit, this exercise thing, which was like, go jog so I don't die. Guys didn't care about that. Unless you were a runner and you're like Steve Prefontaine fan, you didn't care about any of those things. Like, whatever. And now Arnold came and said, yo, you can be a superhero. Like, literally, you can lift weights and look like this. And every man in the world was like, holy shit. This changed everything. So after Arnold in the 70s and 80s, you saw a boom and an explosion of bodybuilding. Now, of course, there were some women there, but at this point, we're almost exclusively talking men are lifting weights, and the rest of men are either not exercising or, for the most part, if we finally let women run the marathon. That started coming in the Olympics in this time. And so women are really getting drifted over there, if anything. So the entire role of women in exercises is behind men in this case. But for the most part, if you're lifting, you're a man in the 70s and 80s, like almost normal. And then we got up into the 90s and 2000s and started to realize, all right, I'm a parent. I can't do a 2.5 hour forearm workout, right? Like I can't be in the gym for hours a day trying to maximize my deltoid size. It just wasn't working. People's jobs and everything's changed, and people started getting hurt. Tons or kept getting hurt. Tons of orthopedic issues. Tons of because it's the volume is so high. And then we're not making better athletes. And so athletes were bodybuilding in the 70s and 80s. Initially, they crushed everybody because they're the only ones that put on any size and strength because no one else was lifting. And then everyone else started lifting. This is, I think, Nebraska, right? Nebraska football, Oklahoma started kicking this stuff off. And that's really the genesis of strength conditioning and sport. And then by the 90s, everyone else had caught up. And it was like, wait a minute. We don't have to lift that way. Maybe we can lift for strength and power and not just maximizing size. And then those athletes started dominating the bodybuilding athletes. And then everyone was like, oh crap. So that thing runs along. And then the 2000s, people come in and say, hey, wait a minute. Instead of being in the gym for 2.5 hours, instead of running for an hour and a half or 60 minutes or whatever, what if I told you I can give you the same cardiovascular benefits and fat loss benefits and muscle gain benefits by doing a 20-minute workout? And that's what CrossFit was. They came in and said, hey, screw all that stuff. We're doing big movements. We're not isolating on machines. We're doing things that are quote unquote more functional, which means moving your body through space, a couple of big exercises, high intensity. You're going to get super tired. You'll be more fit. You'll get strong. And that's great. And that launched and took off like an absolute rocket, right? And so now bodybuilding started losing face. Cardiovascular fitness started going out. At this point, people from the 1980s and 90s who were excited about bodybuilding started becoming adults. And they started getting PhDs. And they started going into laboratories. And they started doing research on strength training. And we started to realize, oh my gosh, this is one of the most significant predictors of how long you're going to live. Your grip strength, actually, we have a model right now. I can predict your cognitive decline over age. I can predict your risk of Alzheimer's all by your grip strength. All this stuff can be done. It's one of the most significant predictors of brain health, as well as overall aging, is not only your leg strength, but your grip strength. And so we started to realize this tremendous connection between it's not just muscles for aesthetics, it's not just muscles for sports, it is muscle for health. And you have to have healthy muscle to age well. And that's what started to happen. So this is all now coalescing at the same time. CrossFit has these enormous benefits so quickly, but then they're crushing everybody because they're doing really big movements to way too much fatigue in really bad positions. Again, I'm generalizing all of these things, and they're doing way too much high intensity way too often. And so there are tons of injuries pop up. And then the honest reality it is people just burned out. So physiologically, people are tanked because you're working all day. You're stressed, and then you go in, and then you go even higher stress in the gym. And eventually that leads to a lot of physiological fatigue. And so more recently, we swung back out of that and said, okay, well, wait a minute. What if we take some components of endurance exercise? What if we take some of the components of like circuit training, some of the components of bodybuilding, and we do kind of the bodybuilding stuff to maintain joint health and to stay safe? And we do some of the cardiovascular components to do lower intensity, get more cardiovascular fitness, and to feel better. We do some of the strength training components. Okay, great. And we blend them all together. And it's like, now I can be fit, I can be strong, and I can do this for forever, and I can stay injury free. And that's really where the field is for the most part right now. We've cherry-picked all these different elements, and we can do this because the research is so clear on the short and long-term benefits of having to have both cardiovascular fitness and muscular fitness to age appropriately and to age the best. And so really, it's impossible to make an argument that either one of those global modes of exercise is better for the other one. The evidence is overwhelming that you have to have both if you're going to give yourself the best chance of living the longest and the best life possible.
I've never heard like a summary timeline like that is
That's
helpful.
cool.
One of the things that stands out to me, I never really thought about this, is obviously I know that technology is changing and o we're always learning because of research, because of science, because of technology, but just the fact that exercise science as a whole is actually recent, right? Like as you said, you go back 50 years, 60 years, and this was all just starting then.
No, totally. I mean, exercise science as a field really formally came about, kind of in the 70s. It was really exercise physiology, but it really didn't take off into its current term until the 2000s for the most part. Now, in the 90s, like for example, I went to college in the early 2000s. And, when I was going on recruiting trips and all that, there was no exercise science programs. There was some by title, but it was exercise science in the perspective of public health, right? So let's get people to check their blood pressure. People need to walk more. And there's no like human performance aspect of this stuff. And it didn't really exist. Most of the people that went into that went into, maybe nursing, or there was a little bit of stuff like that, but there wasn't really a field. So really the ability to like go to school to get a college degree to be a strength and conditioning expert didn't really exist until the last 15 years at best. And now it's one of the most popular majors across the country in all of college. And by no surprise, but yeah, it's a very, very new thing.
At the end of that, when you were talking about what we know from recent research and the combination of all of the things, what, because people are going to want like a, we all want easy answers, but people are going to want something tangible to like, well, what's he talking about? What type of training he's he referring to? It's not CrossFit, it's not bodybuilding, it's not endurance work, like that culmination, optimization, coalescence of those different attributes you mentioned is this is the best for health and longevity. What can people go to as an example of a resource, a training plan, a something tangible to like check out in terms of that?
Yeah, try to rack my brain to see if there's any like plug and play free things people can go do. Let me come back to that. Maybe something will come up for me.
And maybe, yeah, maybe you it's something you send me and then I can like at least point people to the right direction with a link or something later. But
Yeah, I mean, we just released last year under our education company, Biomolecular Athlete is what it's called. It's called a toolkit. And so this is not like necessarily all the background physiology and the theory, but directly toolkits for people to build their own training and nutrition programs. So that is out. It's not free. It's something I sell. So I was trying to think if I have a better answer than that one, not to try to get people to go buy that thing, but that is one. It's just, again, it's the tools we use. It's the actual like files we have and how do we build training programs for any different goal and nutrition programs and supplement programs and all that stuff. So that's it. That is available. I have a ton of free videos on YouTube. I got a lot of sample programs and things like there, like that, all on all those videos, and those are all and always will be free. You can check those out. There's lots of companies that sell like pretty reasonably priced training programs, like Renaissance Periodization is a great company. I don't have any affiliation with them, but they just do great work. So you can buy a training program for them. They're mostly for like muscle hypertrophy, but they could get you going on something. So yeah, I don't have a great answer for you. I would say like here, the long way would be if you watched enough of my YouTube videos, you could do it yourself totally free. That would be the way I could say it. If you don't have that kind of time, then just hire a coach, an online coach would be do it. Obviously, we sell coaching as well, so you can do that, but that's very, those are pretty in-depth programs. So that's kind of what I would point you to.
Narrowing down on a few specific training questions. I mean, some of this you touched on, and I think would be helpful. Just feel free to elaborate or give very more succinct answers because these are more specific questions. Someone wrote in and said, Zone 2 training seems to have a lot of proponents, but it is so time consuming.
Yeah.
Is Zone 2 training really the best way to build endurance? Are there any ways to shortcut, optimize, or lessen the time commitments and still reap the benefits?
Okay. I am not nearly as big of a fan of zone two as other people are. I don't care what zone you're in at all. Like, who cares? It's a made-up number for the most part. You do need to have low intensity sustained threshold training, though. That is great. Now, do you have to do 3.5 hours a week? I think that's a ridiculous ask. Like if that's like you're 3 hours in a week and all you've done is that, you haven't even done any of your other work. Like the people just don't have that kind of time. Quite frankly, I don't do it or even close. So a couple things you can do. Can you build in a 10-minute walk twice a day? Right? Walk the dogs in the morning, walk the dogs at night, something like that. Okay, great. You're building back some step count there. That's fine. Can you build it into other stuff? If you work and you work outside, you're probably doing enough of that work. Right? You're just walking around doing different things. You're fine there. Can you slide it in other ways? That's great. If you can do it a couple times a week, 30 minutes or more a couple times a week, I think for most people, you're in a pretty good spot. I don't really care what zone you're in, to be honest. If you are a cyclist and you, I have one of the athletes or the clients in our coaching program. He sold a company. He's fit in his mid-50s. He sold his company, so he's semi-retired. I mean, he literally rides his bike for 3 hours a day, and then twice a week he rides for 5.5 to 6 hours. I'm like, well, that's phenomenal. And his VO2 max is obnoxiously high. I'm like, that's great, but I don't have time for that. You can absolutely do short, high-intensity stuff. That has to be super, super high though. That will improve VO2 max as much, if not more. I will caution you though, like again, you just don't want that to be all your training or your only training. If you have the ability to add in some lower intensity, longer duration, that's great. But just because you can't do, whatever magical number at whatever magical rate somebody said, don't make that make you go to zero, is my answer. So get in what you can, and do the best you can. Have something that you do once per week that is lower intensity, longer duration. Have something that you do once per week That is maximal intensity. Have something that you do once per week that involves heavy resistance. If you can do that 3 times a week, you're covering your bases all a little bit. And whether you use machines or dumbbells or barbells or a bike or you do sprints or you swim, any of those things can be used for any of that activity. Use what's best for you, most convenient, most realistic, and things you can do that keep you the healthiest so you don't lose training.
Just sounds like all things in life, if you just have a good balance of everything, right? And you're going to be pretty well off.
It goes back to that previous question about focusing on strength versus endurance. It's like, okay, first take 3 days, do one of each that you just said, lower intensity, high intensity, strength and resistance, like start there. And then if you want to improve on strength, add in more strength days. If you want to improve on endurance, add in more endurance days, but don't neglect always having those three attributes.
For the most part, yeah.
You mentioned VO2 max, and actually, preparing for this, I was looking at your Instagram, and one of your more recent posts, you said something along the lines of, there are few things better you can do for your long-term functionality and performance than driving your VO2 max up as high as possible. So my question is, why is that the case? Like, why is it one of the best things you can do? And then any recommendations for improving VO2 max?
Yeah, if there are, I think I said that, well, perfect. There are just few things that are going to determine how long you're going to live more than your VO2 max. You can pick any number of studies here, but these go back to the 1980s. We've known this. Stephen Blair at South Carolina did a ton of research on this. And so now we've got 30 years basically of research on this stuff. And it's just really, really, really clear. When you compare VO2 max to traditional clinical risk factors like blood pressure, cholesterol levels, do you smoke? You have a history of heart disease. Does that run in your family? All of those things are important to pay attention to. And they all will increase your risk of dying for any reason by 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%. If you look at VO2 max, the risk it brings you for death for any reason, for men and women, is typically 3, 4, 5 times higher than any of the things I just mentioned before. You cannot get away with low VO2 max and live a long time. Now, like smoking is not good for you, and having high blood pressure is not good for you, but you can get away with that a little bit. It increases your risk for sure, but you're not doubling, tripling, or quadrupling or 5Xing your risk like you are with VO2 max. So VO2 max, the easy way to think about it is this: why do I care about a surrogate marker of my overall cardiovascular health? A blood marker, some measure of functionality, when I can directly test the maximal ability of my heart. That is exactly what it's telling you. And so you just do not get away with a low VO2 max. You can't live independently after a while, and you just don't survive. We see this routinely. It just doesn't happen. The research here is completely overwhelming. And so, in addition, we don't see a diminishing effects of VO2 max. So the higher that number goes, the higher your survival rate is. With no diminishing, the things like you might say, like, hey, if I squat 500 pounds and I increase my squat from 500 to 600 pounds, am I going to live any longer? Probably not. Like, okay, there's diminishing returns with like your back squat strength, but your VO2 max is not. Just again, you have hundreds of studies on millions of people, and the higher that VO2 max, the higher your survival probability is. Period. The other part about it is it's not just survival, it's functionality. Because if your VO2 max is low, even though you're alive, you can't function. For men, that's about a number called about 18 milliliters per kilogram per minute. For women, it's about 15 or 16 milliliters per kilogram per minute. Below that, simple activities like getting out of bed are 60, 70, 80% of your VO2 max. So you can't live by yourself. You can't do anything. You're basically, you become bedridden at some point. So you might be alive, but you're not there. So keeping your VO2 max high, if you're still alive, you're going to have high function. And that's at the end of the day, that's all we really all care about, right? Like no one wants to be alive just to sit in a bed all day. So I can go on and on, but it is one of the most significant predictors of how long and how well you're going to live of any metric in the world. The only other one that comes close to it is your leg strength. And that'll also again tell us a lot about how long you're going to live because that's the way you interface with the world, right? When you can no longer move and locomote through the planet, then you tend to die very quickly. And so no one wants the ability to lose mobility. In terms of physically moving throughout the world. So how do you improve VO2 max? It's very simple. It's incredibly responsive to training. You can do high intensity only, and that will elevate VO2 max. You can do low intensity only, that will elevate it. You can do a combination. A combination is probably best. You can do it with running. You can do it with the bike. You can do it in the pool. You can do it with sleds. You can push things. You can pull things. You can lift weights. You can do all kinds of stuff. All you have to do is challenge your heart's ability to pump, and it will adapt. It's the easiest principle in the world, right? It's called the SED principle: specific adaptation for imposed demand. So if you want a specific adaptation, in this case, VO2 max to go up cardiovascularly, impose a demand on it. Whatever demand you impose on it will adapt, period. So if you want to challenge your ability of your heart to pump, to bring in and utilize oxygen, do anything that challenges your ability to bring in and utilize oxygen. That system will get better. It goes back to what I talked about earlier. The superpower of human physiology is pattern recognition and adaptability. If it recognizes that pattern, it will adapt very quickly and very specifically. And so really, the idea here is the methods are many, the concepts are few. The concept is just challenge your cardiovascular system. What method? Oh, I don't care. 1,000 methods. What specific protocol? Who cares? It doesn't really matter that much. What equipment? Doesn't matter that much. How many days per week? Doesn't matter that much. Like, any of the answers can work as long as you're challenging your heart often, it'll adapt. And because of that, your VO2 max will go up.
What's the best way to measure it? Are the Garmin watches like somewhat accurate, reliable source to do that?
Rough idea. The gold standard is to go to a lab. Right now, they're actually popping up more and more because people realize how big of a deal this stuff is. And you could typically get a VO2 max test done if you just kind of Google around like VO2 max and testing or something. It'll pop up in your search engine. It usually costs somewhere between $75 to $200 to get it done. If you want the free version, there are a billion estimate equations where you can do the most classic is like a 12-minute Cooper's test. So you run for 12 minutes as far as you can, and you take the distance that you finish, and you take that distance and you plug it into an online calculator, and it'll give you an estimate of your VO2 max. That's scientifically been around for decades. So you can do that. There's a bunch of them. There are sub-max ones if you don't want to do a true max effort, like a 2-minute step test, where you can take your heart rate. Then you step up and down on a small box for 2 minutes, check your heart rate at the end, plug that into an equation, and it will tell you. You can get them from your wearables, but the accuracy is questionable depending on one. If you go with someone like a Garmin or a Polar, this is what they do, right? This is where they started. And so they are generally a little bit better. Iwatches and stuff like that tend to get really, really egregious. They tend to be okay at lower numbers, but they tend to get really off in the moderate to high ones. So I would definitely use a company that this is what they're for, is heart rate, with performance. Eye watches are to give you cell phones. So you can sort of tell the accuracy there.
What's a number range that, would be, what would you say is like, oh, that's your average, or oh, that's pretty dang high?
Yeah, sure. Think about a 0 to 100. I told you kind of line of independence is, we'll call it below 20. All right. So if you're in the bottom 20%, it's hard to move. Highest ever recorded in human history is 98, 99, kind of in that range. There, like people have said that people have hit 100, but it's not been documented. That said, the average, we'll say NBA player, is probably in the low 60s, plus or minus. Most college men that are like kind of physically active are, going to be in the mid 40s, low 40s, something like that. Somebody who's 50 years old and doesn't exercise at all, might be 30, 28, 25, something like that. And so you're not far off from that line of independence, which becomes a problem. And so those are rough numbers. The nice heuristic that I like here is 50 of 50. So I'd love for at 50 years old, be to VO2 max of 50. Which a lot of people will go get tested and they'll be like, oh my God, I'm 28. Like, what the hell? So most people's VO2 max is a lot lower than they think.
Have you, is the, I don't, I know it by the beep test. Is that something relevant,
Yeah,
the
totally.
VO2 max?
Yeah, you can absolutely, those are great tests. There's all kinds of like, again, there's literally hundreds of different estimates. But beep test is not an actual VO2 max test, but it's still a good test of your overall fitness for sure.
You have time for a hunting specific question? I know I can't keep you all day, but I'd love to chat
Yeah,
really quick
I'll make
about.
one more. I'll make a few more minutes for one more hunting question for sure.
All right, perfect. So this is training, but still hunting related. So what recommendations do you have for a nutritional or supplementation strategy when preparing to go or while at, or sorry, when preparing to go to or while at higher elevations? So context of someone from sea level-ish going to hunt at 10,000 feet, right? We've talked about this topic. There's conflicting research. There's people selling you things, etc. Do you have any experience with true science here on what to recommend?
Yeah, I can answer this a couple ways. So I live in Southern California, which is I'm currently flooded right now because it's raining. So I'm at sea level. And last year we actually hunted mule deer in the Tetons, which was I think base camp was at 7,800, and then we rode horses up to about 95. Did most of our hunting, in that 95. So 0 to 10,000, I got you. I went through it last year. I took zero supplements with me whatsoever. I had a very successful hunt, came back with a great mule deer. I was very, very tired at some points of it, but for the most part, I was absolutely fine. And that's generally because I prepared to go up there. But I don't have an altitude chamber or anything like that. But if your overall physiology is in a really good spot and you are in good, your fitness is fine, you should be absolutely fine handling that range. I had never held a shortness of breath. The one time that got me is, we had a probably about a, I don't know, 45-minute run. And I mean run with gear, with rifles, trying to get to a spot. And by the time I, and that was up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. And so that was a pretty brutal 45 minutes. And by the time I got to the hunting spot or the shooting spot, my heart rate was going for sure. But it didn't take that long to recover. I was able to actually get in a position, make a shot, and have a one-shot kill. So it shouldn't be that big of a deal. 1,000 feet is enough to where it starts mattering, but if you can't function at 10,000 feet, even for a low-level guy like me, then I would say your preparation is very poor and your physiology is not in a good spot going into it, is what I'd say, unless you got, a back injury or something like that. So that would be my very first answer. And then before I give you like more specifically supplement question, I would love to know from you guys, like what are the supplements you hear of the most? I'm interested to hear what you guys hear as things you should take, and then I'll answer back after that.
I mean, there's some non-medical supplements that are marketed towards hunters as like supposedly helping with altitude, and I don't even know what those active ingredients are. They're non-prescription, etc. They're
Sure.
more they're more marketing supplements, I think, to put it bluntly. And then occasionally, I know people have done this personally, things like Diamox, to truly have like, hey, from my doctor, I got Diamox for
Sure.
this hunt or for this adventure. So those are kind of the two categories I would say I'm aware of personally.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, go ahead. If you got anything else, I'd love to know.
No, yeah, I was gonna say, I don't pay attention to it at all. Like I've just personally in Idaho get up to 10,000 feet quite often. I've just never had an issue. So it's not something I've ever been aware of, but certainly no guys that have gotten altitude sickness. Hunting
Yeah.
at typically it's in Colorado. You get to 12,000 feet, stuff like that.
Bingo. There you go. Yeah. So again, a 10K, you should be fine. Like you might have some issues getting up to 12 or more, but at 9,000, 10, like you should be fine. Dimoxy, like if you want to use a diuretic, fine. So if you're, I guess the question is this, do you want to know about medications for altitude sickness? That's a very, very different answer than supplementation to perform your best. Here's what happens. If you're a guy like me, sea level guy, and you go to 10,000 feet, well, because the partial pressure of oxygen at that elevation, or the partial pressure of air at that elevation is lower, even though oxygen, this is a very common misconception, there is not less oxygen at altitude. It's the exact same amount of oxygen at altitude that there is at sea level. It's not less at all. But the partial pressure, meaning the pressure of the air, is much, much, much lower. So as you open your mouth to breathe, the difference in pressure between your lungs and the air outside there's very little gradient. And so if you want to think about it like this, at sea level, inside your chest, I'll make up a number, make it easy. The pressure inside your chest is at 2. And then in the environment, the pressure is at 100. So when you open it up, all the air wants to go from this really high pressure atmosphere into your low pressure lungs. So air just flows in. When you get up to altitude, it becomes 50-50. So you open up your mouth and air doesn't care to move because it's equally balanced. There's no pressure driving it into your lungs. So the problem with altitude is the pressure issue, not the oxygen concentration. If you can get enough air in, there will be no issue whatsoever, but you can't. Okay, great. So oxygen concentrations get lower because of the partial pressure, which means you have to work a lot harder to breathe. You're actively opening up and pulling your lungs and trying to increase the pressure, or to decrease the pressure in your lungs. What happens is this. So pressure is affected by space. So when you're not breathing, your lungs are small. When you take a big breath in, what you're doing is you're using the muscles around your rib cage to open your rib cage up. This expands your lung. As you guys know, if you're imagine yourself in a bedroom and you got 10 little kids in the bedroom, and then all of a sudden you cut the bedroom size in half. Well, now the pressure, like in those 10 little kids, this gets, wow. Well, if you double the room size, there's way more space for it to move. There's a lot less physical pressure, right? You don't have any kids running around bumping into shit. So when you open up your breath, you've doubled the room size. So now the pressure gets very, very, very low. And so now the pressure in your lungs is way lower than the pressure outside, so air will come in. But you're having to do that way more often than you're used to, and so you're breathing a lot more. This then makes you change into a state of breathing too much. So you're breathing a lot. Breathing a lot trips sensors in your brain called chemoreceptors. And they will actually kick on adrenaline. And that's normal, right? It's a good response. It's like, hey, we're having a hard time breathing, kick off adrenaline, right? And so now you've got a heightened state of adrenaline. This kicks off cortisol. This is a stress responding hormone. This kicks in blood glucose regulation because you're into what's called sympathetic drive. So this is fight or flight. So you're literally in fight or flight. You're now biasing towards carbohydrate metabolism because it's faster, but it is more anaerobic. And this entire system is also a cycle. So the fact that you have more glucose going senses more signal, and so you're back in this whole spin cycle. So supplementation-wise, some of the things you can do are to look at things like arginine-based or nitric oxide-based supplements. So these are vasodilators. This opens up your blood vessels, makes it easier for you to transport things throughout. This is beetroot juice, stuff like that. Those can help. Anything that allows you to enhance oxygen transportation is going to help this entire system, calming it all back down. You can try that. You can look at herbal things like rhodiola. Rhodiola is a cortisol modulator and is a stress adapter. So that can help. Also, it helps muscular endurance. So something like that could be effective potentially as well. There are other global herbals that again tend to like calm you down a little bit to keep you into parasympathetic. That makes sure you're not over breathing. Because a lot of times what can happen is this elevated breath rate gets too high, too much, and you're into like a little bit of a panic response. And so really you just need to calm down. So those would be some of the ones that I'd say supplementation-wise, outside of a diuretic. Now, the reason that Dymox is working is because it's a diuretic. It's getting you to pee more. It's getting you to pee more so that you lower your total blood volume. And you're lowering your total blood volume because your blood pressure is up because you're breathing so hard and you're breathing so heavy. And so you're kind of lowering your total blood volume, which will happen in response. So if you make sure your hydration is on point, this will also then relieve some of your altitude sickness issues because you're keeping your total blood volume in check there. So that is another big component of it. And the last one would be your electrolytes. If you're over breathing, this can put you into what's called respiratory alkalosis. So it's the opposite of acidic. So your respiratory system becomes alkalitic. In response to that, your kidneys will adjust how much sodium it is holding on to make it metabolic acidosis. So the entire system becomes balanced. If then therefore you're making sure your electrolytes and hydration are on point, you're resolving that issue and your symptoms will be greatly reduced and your performance will be enhanced at the same time. So those would be the great starting places. Make sure your hydration is on point. Make sure your electrolytes are dialed in. That will calm the system down a little bit. Make sure you're enhancing oxygen transportation if you need to, with again something like a beetroot juice or an arginine, and then a stress responding adapter, something like a rhodiola, to kind of keep the system calm. those would be all sufficient for a 0 to 10,000 on.
So good. That's the best answer I've heard of, not just like, oh, you should make sure your hydration's good, because I've even given that advice because I've experienced the benefits of it firsthand, but like actually understanding now why that makes sense. So thank you so much. Man, Andy, this has been phenomenal. Thank you. Thank you for being willing to do it, for sharing your knowledge. Certainly appreciated time. If you ever want to come back on and just talk hunting too, we would love to do that. And I won't even bug you about quote unquote work and all of the research and science, but this has been so cool. Thank you.
Yeah, my man. Actually, to Maui here pretty soon to do some axis deer. I work with a company out there called Maui Nui Medicine.
Yeah. Nice.
So, yeah, phenomenal company out there. And then I'll be in Wyoming to do a bear hunt, spring bear hunt, here in a few months as well. So, got some fun
Awesome.
trips coming.
Very cool. Well, before I do let you go, just let us know all the things, all the places, if people wanna follow you, see your company, any of the stuff you mentioned, like feel free to give us all those places, and then I'll be sure to add links to the show notes as well.
Sure. My social media, Instagram and Twitter are Science Communication. So if you want to learn more about this stuff, all free. That and YouTube as well. Those are all places. I have my own podcast coming out in a little bit later this spring called Perform, and it's really exactly what we did today. So it is all about kind of the science of performing at your best. So that's a short series that'll come out a couple times a year. So that'll be raging. We just launched. I mentioned my sleep company, Absolute Rest. So this is by far the world's most advanced sleep diagnostics and technologies, and we're able to actually build functional sleep laboratories in your own home. So you don't have to go to a sleep clinic, anything like that. So if you're interested in that, you can go there. I mentioned Biomolecular Athlete as our education company. So we've got courses and stuff like that to learn more about writing your own programs. Then we've got, I mentioned our coaching program, Rapid Health and Performance. If you want actual coaching, it's got a couple of different levels there. Then I think lastly is just last week we launched what's called Vitality Blueprint. This is premium performance blood work. So this is blood work done for you for those that want to perform at your best. It's not about sort of disease and things like that. You're not being compared against normal values, but really is what markers should you look at to perform at your best? How should those be interpreted and analyzed based on healthy and based on optimal performance? And then what specific and detailed exact programs and protocols, exercise, lifestyle, supplements, nutrition, all based on your KPIs done for you. So that just launched last week on pre-sale and it's doing phenomenal. So people can go check that out at vitalityblueprint.com.
Well, there you have it, guys. I hope that you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Thanks again to Andy for sharing his time, experience, and knowledge with us. Be sure to check out the links in the show description to learn more about the resources that Andy mentioned. And as always, if you have anything for us, you can send an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. It'd be great to hear from you. Also, be sure that you are subscribed to our show in any podcast app so that you receive future episodes automatically, and we'll talk to you soon.